Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the JT Fox Podcast Networks. As you know, we've interviewed some of the biggest celebrities in the world, Pacino, Stallone, Schwarzeneggers, billionaires, entrepreneurs, literally game changers from all over the world. But today, I don't think I've ever been so excited because in a world where we are very much attached to brands, you know, whether it's a shoe or whether it's a polo shirt or anything, for me, I like Nando's. Now, some people absolutely know Nando's. Some people have no idea what Nando is. But after this interview, you will know what Nando's about. It is probably the most famous restaurant in South Africa that has spawned globally as well. And we have the CEO here today of the South Africa, Middle East, and Asia. And he is extremely accomplished. He has been one of the top business leaders, but not only as leading Nando's, but Unilever, PepsiCo, Cadbury, Schweppes, SAB Miller. And his extensive success has literally been on a global base and very down to earth. And he's brought to you by his live from South Africa, Jeff White, the CEO of Nando's. Welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, first of all, my life is now complete. And so now I can officially end this podcast because it probably won't get either. It's very interesting because when I first went to South Africa, I remember I was speaking thousands of people and then someone let me take you to Nando's. I had no idea what that is. And I came in and in essence, it was chicken. And who doesn't like chicken? And the first time it happened, literally by far the best tasting chicken I'd ever had. And then you had the fries with the peri peri. And then the amount of times I was traveling to South Africa for business, literally the... you know, I start going there like twice a day, like literally I go lunch and dinner. It was so good. And it wasn't like that junk.
Super fan.
Yes. Super fan. Yes. More than Trevor Noah. So we'll have to talk about that. So it became like the food was good, not fattening. And, you know, and then ironically enough, I never did research. I'm in London one time. I'm walking by. I'm like, oh my God, there's a Nando's. And then I walk by, you know, Kuala Lumpur, and there was a Nando's, right? Interestingly enough, the quality of consistency was very much the same. We could talk about that, of a product. And then I heard it's coming to the United States in Washington, D.C., and which obviously, you know, to go to Washington just for chicken would be outrageous. But then I lived in Chicago, and lo and behold, a Nando's opens on Michigan Avenue. Another Nando's literally opens right behind my building. And fun fact is, during the pandemic, I literally went there almost every day because most places were kind of closed. And the Nando's that I was at was literally across the street from a hospital in Chicago. And so that, because that hospital was busy, it stayed open. And so, and you know, it was a big ordeal to go get your food and everything and 12 masks and all this stuff, but it remained open. And then I moved you know, to Nashville and other places where they don't have a Nando's as well. And so when the opportunity came to interview, I was very honored. But first, so people understand, Nando's is a peri peri chicken chain with, you know, primarily centered around chicken and lots of sides. The salad bowl was a brilliant business move, by the way, which added a healthy component to it as well. So Jeff, you've been at this for a long time. So what is your background? How did you get started in Nando's?
Well, you touched a little bit on my career earlier. So I grew up in FMCG. I worked for Yum in the UK and then in South Africa for a while. And about 10 years ago, I was asked to come and join the Nando's South African business. I joined as CEO there. And then about 6 years ago, took on the rest of the region. So Africa, Middle East, and Asia, as you again touched on earlier. But I've worked on Miller in the States in marketing. I've worked in the UK with Unilever, with Exxon, and with PepsiCo, and in South Africa with SAB Miller and Cadbury Schweppes, and some private equity work also in South Africa.
So explain to me, in South Africa, there were ads about Nando's. There was advertising. It was usually poking fun at politics or what's going on to sell, very cheeky marketing. In the United States, nothing. Overseas, nothing. What is the business model where it thrives on 0% marketing? It really does. It's quite fascinating, almost like a word to mouth, me talking here about Nando's. And I'm sure if people, like, regardless, someone's going to try Nando's somewhere after this interview. What is the marketing mind? Because I know that you start earlier on getting involved in the marketing aspect, but how come in South Africa there is, but then the rest of the world, it's kind of like just none?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's none in the rest of the world. I think in South Africa, this is where the brand started. and the guys were trying to get maximum bang for the buck in the early days. They didn't have big marketing budgets. They wanted a big impact. And they took some risks. They pushed the envelope in terms of what they said, who they went after, the jokes that they made. We certainly made some ads in that period that we would struggle to make anywhere now. But they punched massively above their weight in South Africa, really put the brand on the map. The brief that the founder of the company, Robbie Brosen, gave to our ad agency here was scare me. And some of the ideas they came back with were definitely on the edge, but had huge impact, really put the brand on the map. In the UK, which is our biggest market now, we tend to market through the restaurant experience. So a huge focus on the customer experience, on design, and obviously the food. Australia has mirrored the kind of approach we've had in South Africa. And on smaller budgets, we have taken on social issues in the States. So, you know, for a very small brand, we ran a very successful campaign around everyone is welcome, possibly a little bit of a counter to some of the things Trump was saying when he was in power. But I think that resonated with a lot of people. So I think the brand positioning and personality and point of view is consistent, but we manage it slightly differently depending where we are in the world.
Well, usually, like, there's no TV advertising. I mean, outside, I'm talking about, at least in South Africa, what I've seen in America, there's no, I've never seen a Nando's ad. So maybe social media posts or things like that. But is it designed by on purpose? Normally, a business will do 14% of its marketing budget, let's say applied. I mean, I'm just using around numbers into marketing.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to be that case. Is there like a specific kind of strategy about, one, we'll save the money on marketing and we'll put it in high traffic areas instead. So spend more maybe on the lease of the location. So by itself, the foot traffic will be a better marketing than be at a place that doesn't maybe have as much foot traffic and no one really knows about it. Has a very much of a neighborhood feel. It doesn't have its sort of a big box kind of your McDonald's on a side corner. It's literally inserted specifically big for lunch crowds, you know, or where there's going to be, is that the model in essence?
I think we definitely invest in the customer experience. We individually design every restaurant. We are unique, or maybe nearly unique, in that every Nando's is individually designed. There's no carbon cutout design. They're all different. And they're all designed to maximize the space that we're in. We put a lot of effort into the customer experience as well. So, you know, that is definitely
an example. You've said that three times.
Disproportionate for us. Yeah.
Give me an example of what you mean by customer experience that as a CEO you're driving to be. And I will say, what you say actually matches what I experienced as a historian in Nando's, have vast experience.
I think we spend a tremendous amount of time and effort in looking after the people that work for us, in helping them to realize the potential. And, you know, we look to change lives through being employed by the company. And we look at that as being an inside out brand. So if the people that work for us feel great about working for the company, then our customers can feel that when they come into our restaurants. Over and above that, we will actually give the restaurants budgets to surprise and delight customers. So if they see an opportunity, someone's down, someone's having a bad day, they can step in and really just surprise them with something that you wouldn't see in a normal restaurant. We also, and I've said it a couple of times, but you know, the actual environment that we create is also quite special. We've got South African art on the walls and a tremendous effort on design. We play Afro-Luso music, which is carefully created from South Africa in our restaurants across the world. So those are some of the touches that we focus on. In terms of the advertising question, I think, you know, historically when most advertising was broadcast, 15%, the number you mentioned, was a reasonable number. I think that's changed with the advent of social media. So I think media budgets are more about production, less about flighting. So I think we would probably spend a smaller proportion than that, but we're probably not alone in that. I think the whole industry has moved. But we try and make communication that people will respond to, will be engaged by, that they will enjoy, that will also hopefully positively enhance their view of the brand. So, but we wouldn't spend 15, but we do spend a significant amount of broadcast media in several markets, but in every market, social media. And I think social media that is of the moment, responsive to market conditions and events, is something that we put a lot of time into as well.
So there is an experience of going to eat at Nando's. I mean, I remember, God, I was in the UK about 4 months ago. Of course, I went to Nando's and it was actually busy. It was a line outside, very fast and efficient. Come in, get your number, order, bring it back. I mean, the food comes back extremely fast, and which is good. And there's and I think in the UK is a little bit different. I think people will have a drink or alcohol, which is very different than some of the other Nando's, obviously. So it's a more of a, you know, and the way some of the tables are set up, long tables as well, especially the one I go sometimes at Houston train station. So like 5, 6, 10 friends will gather together, very much of a dining experience that, you know, people don't necessarily go to Burger King or McDonald's to have that, the quick in and out. So it also can serve and then people in and out quickly. How did the pandemic affect that? Because obviously in markets like London, which was completely shut down, in essence, was a ghost town. And then you had the United States, for example, you had downtown Chicago, the location I was. I mean, they were obviously down, way down, but they were still kind of making money. The one on Michigan, which is probably one of the prime locations downtown Chicago, I don't know if you've seen it, that was like 100% driven by offices. And which, by the way, during the day, if there's offices there. A lot of the offices, and still to this day, have not come back as much. And of course, it's different now. But at the time, you have these big leases, you have the big things. And in South Africa also, there was very tough, stringent. How did you navigate that? And was the company at any point imperial, or did the takeout order of delivery, was that enough to cover? Or was it a situation that you just had to hunker down? Because there are closures in Canada. I remember of Nando's as well. So how did you navigate that? And how did you guys see that?
Yeah, that's a lot of questions you've thrown at me there.
I got 4,000, so I'm just trying to get.
I mean, I think the business profile differs from market to market. It started as a takeaway concept and has migrated to a dine-in concept in South Africa. It started very much as a dine-in concept in the UK, and the out-of-home channels takeaway delivery have grown there. So there's been a little bit of convergence from a different starting point. Where we are very dependent on dine-in with very expensive rentals, and then the world shuts down as it did with COVID, that clearly was very challenging. And I think one of the hardest parts of that was we didn't know how long that time window of closure would be. So fortunately, we have enormously supportive shareholders. We have two main shareholding groups, the Brosen family and the Endhoven family. And they empowered the management team to make the right decisions that we'd look back on with pride later. So we paid all our suppliers in full. We paid rentals. We paid all of our people and weathered the storm. And I think it was a very tough time for everyone personally and for the business financially. But with the backing of our shareholders, I think when things eased, we were able to bounce back with a lot of goodwill from the people who work for us, from our suppliers, from our landlords, and I think also from customers. So it was a very tough time, but I like to think we navigated that as well as anyone could. And I do look back with pride on the decisions that we made.
Was it, at the end, compared to what was making in 2019, were you guys like losing money, or because of the takeaway obviously was still there, was enough to sort of break even? And was it challenging? Because I think you did close some stores in Canada during COVID, right? Specifically in Toronto, if I'm not mistaken, where I used to live there as well, where I was born. Some of the Nando's just shut down. I don't know if they've reopened since, but I remember at that time that was a, you know, because it was prolonged, right? I mean, especially downtown locations, where a lot of the downtown areas in America, per se, and even London, it just kind of disappeared. People went to the suburbs and didn't go down. So, you know, and a lot of the lunch crowd went away.
Yes. Well, we had to close completely in many places. Oh, wow. South Africa, we had a complete shutdown. No channels open. Restaurants completely closed. The UK
really?
Was
not
completely
even delivery.
Closed for an extended period. No channels open at all. Complete shutdown. So in that instance, you have all the normal costs, but no revenue. So that was very tough. Situation in Canada, we'd actually been looking at a rationalization of our network there. And I think during COVID, we thought that the time was right to make a decision on closing a few stores. It was a very small number. That market is a strong one for us and is profitable and now growing again. But we did have to take a tough decision and close a couple of restaurants there. But I think that was the only market in the world, and it was coincidental with COVID rather than because of COVID.
What is your role as the CEO? Obviously, you've been there in a while. What are your day-to-day? Just to understand. So what percentage of Nando's in, let's say, South Africa, UK, in the Asia where you handle, are actually corporate-owned versus franchise? Because it is a franchise. Versus the United States, where it's 100% corporate owned right now?
Yes, it depends a bit where you are in the world. So South Africa is about 50-50 company owned and franchise. We probably not far off that in Australia. The US and the UK are fully company owned. Our Malaysia business that you mentioned earlier is a joint venture with a local partner on the ground. So the ownership structure varies from place to place, but the UK and the US and India are all fully company-owned businesses.
Oh, wow. And what's the difference as a, go back to your role as the day-to-day CEO before I sort of dive into the question about what is it that you do? Because it's very challenging. If you think about it, you have, you know, South Africa, which is its own dynamics. It's the brand, which it's such a high standard and probably one of the top brands in South Africa in terms, probably has 100% brand recognition, I'm sure, in South Africa. And then you have the UK, which is obviously the biggest market, ironically. And then you have Africa, which is very challenging. I've done business in Africa places, and then Asia. So it's a mishmash of culturally different, which, by the way, for everyone to know, it's basically Portuguese chicken in essence in South Africa. But we think of it as like it was South African company, but really the origins of the company, it's, you know, Portuguese. In nature. So this is a very kind of challenge.
I mean, actually, the origin of the food is a melding of African spice in Mozambique, which was a Portuguese colony. And it's the combination of flame-grilled spatchcock chicken with African spices. So actually, Mozambique, which is Afro-Portuguese, is the essence of the food. But the geography that I look after certainly has a variety of challenges. You've got different economic stages. You've got different political environments. So South Africa, as you touched on, is very, very challenging. You know, we've got big electricity supply problems at the moment, which is causing chaos. Economic growth is low. Consumers are under pressure. Unemployment is very high. And I think, you know, you need to work with whatever you're given. So, you know, we work on value, we work on affordability, and try and give a great customer experience at the same time, along with innovation around our food in South Africa. India, if anything, is a lower income place than South Africa. And again, enormously driven by affordability and value, but also by experience and a great interest in Western brands. So trying to balance those two things to position the brand strongly and also to make money. Africa has currency problems, money movement problems, political shenanigans going on. So, but we have a lot of experience in that area, and we manage it, I think.
Yeah, so some South African brands have not been able to survive. I think Pick and Pay tried to do their supermarkets, mind you, so bigger operating costs, just the exchange, getting the money out, the political situation made it very, very challenging. What are some of the things that you deal on a day-to-day basis, like your role, so people don't understand, get inside your brain, like you get in, and by the way, are you guys back into an office, or is kind of all that back to normal where it's just like it was before, or is it still remote in fact, and what are your day-to-days look like?
I think we were all surprised by how effectively we were able to function when everyone was forced to work from home during COVID. And I think people have enjoyed the flexibility of that. And in a place like South Africa, where I currently live, the load shedding electrical position where half the traffic lights don't work mean that travel times have become very long. So practically it's tougher to get from A to B than it was historically, and that's potentially dead time. So I think, you know, largely we have moved back to offices being fully open and available as workplaces. But I don't think we've returned to quite the same balance of people being based in the office as was the case pre-COVID. But it's kind of balanced out. But I'm a great believer in delivering outputs rather than inputs. So I like to give people flexibility in how they work. And I think that's how you get the best out of them. So yeah, we were more office-based pre-COVID than we are now, but I think the level of flexibility and productivity is probably higher than it was before.
What about
and then you asked about
yeah. What do you do
sorry,
all day?
So you asked me about my day to day. Yeah, sorry. So I guess, you know, with a wide geography, you know, we're looking at a lot of supply chain challenges. We're managing the flows of money. We're managing currencies. We're managing pricing in markets with a lot of inflation currently. Marketing is a big part of what we do and what we give to our franchise partners. And we're also looking at developing new markets. So we're very small in a place like India. We're looking at how we expand from that base of this huge population and opportunity. So I'm moving from country to country, business unit to business unit. I would say marketing and supply chain are my big focus, along with working with our partners.
The consistency of the product is quite remarkable, right? And having in the last month and a half in Nando's in Australia, the UK, America, and now Canada, where I am here today, very consistent. Is it the sauce? Because normally you would think is the chicken would be different, whatever. I mean, the sauce is the sauce. It tastes the same, but it's yes. It's very interesting, the consistency of the product, which is sometimes very rare, considering you have different regions, different tastes, especially, you know, not yes. all chickens are created yeah. equal. So how do you guys maintain yeah. the quality of the product and the consistency, which is a big part. So if anybody goes to Nando's, they want to be able to, oh, wow, that was amazing. I want to go back to somewhere else and say, yeah. well, it was better in South Africa than it was here, right? You've done a good job. Yes. What's the secret to that?
Yeah. One of the points of difference of our brand is that we only use fresh chicken. So it's all locally sourced, mm-hmm. but it is sourced to a very high, very consistent, tight specification. So the base chicken we use is of high quality everywhere. Then our marinades and bastings are either made of one of two places in the world and then exported to all the markets that we're in. So there is absolute quality control and consistency there. And we 24-hour marinade all of the chicken before it gets cooked and grilled. And that also comes from central points. So these two central points where we produce the bastings themselves. So I think high quality fresh chicken, and then consistency of marinades and bastings across the world. They're literally the same bastings that we use.
The sauce is sold in supermarkets in the United States, and I've ordered it on Amazon.
Yes, we sell most places in the world, yeah.
Right. What percentage of revenues has become the outside of just outsourcing the sauce thing, which is quite impressive. Like, I saw someone buy it, and they picked up the bottle, and just out of curiosity, I'm like, I picked up the sauce. I'm like, have you been to Nando's? Like, no, I just like the sauce. And I'm like, it was very interesting to someone that had never been to Nando's but picked up the spice sauce while I was at the supermarket. And yeah. Is that more of like a profit center, the sauce, because the margin or this, or is it more like a yeah. almost like a business card to actually go to the store and eat more chicken?
Yes. I mean, I think it's both. It's quite a nice lead in to the brand. So that unique peri-peri sauce that you can buy in supermarkets. So we lead in a place like the States. We'd have much wider availability of our supermarket sauces than our restaurant footprint. So it's kind of forward marketing for the restaurants. But it's also a very successful business in its own right. I'd need to check the exact numbers, but I think if you compare it in terms of a global grocery business to our restaurant business units, it's either the second or third biggest profit generator for the group.
That's crazy. A couple more questions. The world, and I saw you work for SAB Miller and you work for big brands. You've seen things in America. You saw, you know, Budweiser. Now it's down $26 million dollars a month. Target. You saw Chick-fil-A just yesterday, just to basically say, we are going to do this, which ironically, Chick-fil-A 5 years ago was just chastised because of their views against, you know, only Christian values and against gays. And they, like, it was a big deal. And all of a sudden now they're for the people. And, you know, for a while, people just kind of allowed that to happen. Some of the ads in South Africa, when I first saw, I thought they were funny, but you're right, in today's market, people like the chicken. They like the product. They like the beer. You know, they like the food. And now there has been this sort of corporate infusion to instill values that some of the customers be like, this has nothing to do with chicken. And I would argue that when the kneeling down of the Nike effect happened, people just, when Kaepernick knelt during the American flag, people just, some used the stop brand and the brand went up. That was the first, because of the demographics that people buy. Now it's completely turned around where it's kind of like boycott Braun. As the CEO, is there a fine line right now? Because the last thing you want is a scandal like that. I mean, it'd be crazy not to see that at the cost of the shareholders and the investors and the partner as well. But where does that line between, your job is to deliver great food experience and chicken, not necessarily to bestow views upon other people, which are different for everybody. Like we may have different views to everybody. It's become very apparent that it is a problem in America right now. I'm sure you work for a giant beer company. I mean, there was a video on TikTok where at a country concert, all the beers were gone except the Bud. Like nobody was taking a Bud. I was just quite remarkable as well. And I don't think I ever recover from that. Or if that recover time heals thing, how do you view that as a CEO now? The balance between, yes, we want to do good, but also we have a business to run. We are business strength, we're profit, we have partners, shareholders. How does that weigh for you as a CEO right now?
Yeah, I think we've got a very interesting combination of factors at work. I think you've got a far greater interest from consumers in a brand having a point of view, what it does as well as what it says. But at the same time, there's a tremendous sensitivity to what brands say. So they want you to have a view, but they're also incredibly sensitive to whatever standpoint.
They want a view as long as you agree with their view. They want a view as long as you agree with your view, right? They don't want to be like, yes. Well, if I believe this, I want you to believe this. If you don't, I want to cancel you. So it's kind of like, I believe in freedom of speech as long as you agree with me.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite phrases is, I love dogmatic people as long as they agree with me. So that's kind of what you're saying. Right. I think, if you found a company on a strong set of values and you live those values and what you talk about is consistent with what you do and you accept that that would please everyone, then that is the best that you could do. But I think not having a point of view is a very weak position for a company or a brand. So, and I think as long as that's founded on strong principles, then you live with the consequences.
What would you say is the key to success in general, right? You've traveled the world, you've met all kinds of people, you've seen all kinds of businesses, you've worked for some of the biggest brands in the world. What would you, for people that are watching this, entrepreneurs and people who want to aspire, whether in the career or in their business, what is the key from Jeff White's perspectives?
I think in any business, you need to work out what your point of difference and advantage is. If you don't have a differentiated business, then you will eventually die. It might take a while, but it will eventually die. And I think having defined that difference and advantage, you need to work on extending it and making it stronger and adding to it over time. And if around that you can build a competent organization with great people in supply chain, great people in marketing, great people in operations, then collectively they give the customers a great experience, and that's incredibly important as well. So, the core is the brand, and then that has to be delivered. And I think the essence of any successful company is that it has something that no one else offers, and they evolve that over time so it stays strong.
Well, also brand consistency. And that's one thing Nando's probably does better than just most, very, very effectively. Consistency of product, consistency of messaging, consistency of quality of food. Good. Two last questions very quickly. Number one, is there such thing as a Nando's black card? People want to know, or I want to know, is there a Nando's black card? I've told magically there may be a Nando's black card somewhere. Is that a myth? Is that a rumor? And then how come I don't have a black card? I got an Amex one. I think a Nando's one would be far more valuable than my black card. So is there such a thing as a Nando's black card?
I wouldn't know. And if I did, I couldn't tell you.
That's the thing. They're so secretive. It doesn't matter. It's like it may or may not exist. By the way, I will be waiting by the phone to see, by the mail to see if one comes in every single day. Last question. America is, and you said the same thing in the UK, is own 100% by the sort of by the company itself, whether they have investors or align with a private equity. What would be the difference in a market like America, where it's so big and there's so many different territories, right? To be 100% corporate owned, as opposed to as you do the 50-50 you have in South Africa and in the UK, obviously looks as 100%. Is that a profitability thing? Is it because the brand is so strong and the results are so strong that and the collateralization of all these restaurants so strong that it's easier just to go funding directly and it's just about setting the team? What's the basis, especially in America being one of the biggest markets in the world, especially for chicken? I mean, if you take a look at Chick-fil-A, a different model, how they do, it's quite interesting how their franchise model is, but what's the play for that in the United States?
Well, you know, I think our major shareholder, Robbie Eindhoven, built the business in the UK, and he did that by creating a new market segment. So he went into prime locations with top quality design, great crockery, you know, proper glassware, and a kind of restaurant experience that was less formal, because you ordered up front, paid up front, and then went to your seat and the food was brought to you. And he priced that somewhere between quick service restaurant and full sit down dining, and it was massively successful. So he created a new restaurant segment and then built it tremendously powerfully over the last 20 odd years. The reason that we are going with company restaurants in the States is such a massive market, as you said, and we want to make sure that we have complete control over adapting the Nando's brand for the States before we scale. And we have that control where we maintain company ownership.
Is there a, you know, Chick-fil-A had said they have a 30-year plan. It's interesting because I was trying to do business with Chick-fil-A. And I'm like, I had connections to, you know, business and royal family connection there. And they're like, okay, we'll bring Chick-fil-A to Dubai, which is obviously a big chicken area. And then we'll just bring it everywhere, right? And they're like, no, we are part of our plan, our vision. And it doesn't right now include that. And so there is there a 30-year plan or a 20-year plan? Does that make sense in a way? It's hard because the market changes. But I think food will always be food. Is it that thought out of?
You know, I mean, I think a market as big as the US is a long-term play if you're going to do it well. And, you know, I mean, you're talking about the guys, the Watch Your Podcast. One restaurant that is badly positioned will probably cost you what three good restaurants make. So location is incredibly important, and building a network with tremendous care is critical if you're going to be successful. So I think any restaurant brand, no matter how big, puts a lot of time into how they grow. And if you try and grow too quickly, then I think you're prone to making mistakes. So I, in a big market like the States, I think a 30-year plan is entirely reasonable.
They are opening up one in Dallas and Addison, ironically. I was supposed to open this summer. It's opening up in September. As you see, I'm very well aware of what goes on in the world.
You are very well informed. I'm impressed.
Yes, I know, but it's interesting because I do events there. Someone said they're opening up in Texas, and it was like happened to be at a hotel where we do a lot of business and events. And I'm like, oh my God, right across the street, Whole Foods, a nice area, very busy shopping and mall. The question is, what would it take if I funded a Nashville one? You can run the thing, I don't care. If I put one in Nashville, and it'll become my de facto, I'll be the guy in the corner. You know, the mob guys are like, come here, Johnny. But I could be the guy in the corner booth. And then I could just eat Nando's, be on my laptop. I'd be like, did you see this interview with Jeff? You need to watch this as well. What would be the odds of me getting a Nando's? You guys can run it. I don't care about it. I'll fund it if it expedites things. Not that you guys need any money. What would it take for having Nashville? Nashville loves chicken. Well, I love chicken. And so I know exactly where to put it.
Now we know you're such a big fan. We're going to bump Nashville right up our list of places to open in the States. We'll be there soon.
I look at this. It's not that I'm a – I kind of looks at this, a super fan. Maybe it's because I like the – and this is a perfect example. When you like the product a lot – and by the way, they're done little things, just so you know. For example, I'd go there a lot, right? And the managers knew me and stuff like that. And to be like, oh, you know, here's, you know, 20% off for neighborhood, you know, and I didn't ask for it, right? The neighborhood app. And then because I was going there every day, with the Nando's app, like I was getting points and credits. I mean, it was amazing. You know, like sometimes I was eating for free. And it was just the, you know, and they knew your name, and it just like the feel like it felt like a very close. And when people give like that and care, and it's a good product, a good food, you want to tell people. I think it's a perfect example for those in business. When you become a de facto brand ambassador, I never got paid from Nando's. In fact, probably should pay me after this interview. But and I think that's a perfect example of knowing, because obviously I'm the type of person that if I like something, I want to know behind what's happening, you know, how much it costs to open a store, where is it at, where are the profit centers, right? It's just because that's how my business mind works as well. But this is a very good example of word to mouth, which I don't know if people do that about McDonald's anymore, but that's why McDonald's has got to spend, you know, $6 million on a Super Bowl commercial to get the word out as well. So it is really, in a way, you built a brand on a word to mouth driven concept, which sometimes is risky, but in this case of Nando's globally, it's done a very good job, and it's been very much driven by you. And so I definitely appreciate there. I'm going to give you the final words. If you were to describe Nando's in what were one word, how would you describe Nando's?
Jeez. Exciting.
And here, no one ever thought about chicken being excited, but trust me, if you do the extra hot in your mouth, it'll be very exciting as well. Ladies and gentlemen, that is Jeff White, CEO of Nando's. I appreciate it. I encourage everyone to give it a try. And I've never heard anybody say, I don't like Nando's. And if you do, then there's something psychologically wrong with you at a point. And then also I expect my Nando bucks and my Nando black card to come in, and my Nando's location with my booth in the corner says JT Fox there as well. But thank you for giving us also lessons on business and a lot of the strong fundamentals of business, of customer care, customer experience, and, you know, empowering your people, overcoming adversity, surviving, weathering the boat. Strategic scaling is another example of not going too big too soon to dilute and mess up the brand, which is a great point, right? You never got a second chance at making a first impression with a customer. And this has been a perfect execution of exactly how you build a brand, no matter how big or how small the lessons were here. Jeff White, thank you for being on this great interview, everybody. If you like this, like, comment, share, because it's not about chicken. It's a business of people. And if you take care of your people, they will take care of your product, and they'll take care of putting the word out as well, time and time after again as well. Make sure you subscribe, like, share, whatever it is to do. Thank you so much. We'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.